And we also realize, and I think part of being here tonight is an opportunity, or today I should say, is an opportunity in promoting, is the idea that if we were able to build the public case for needs budgets in a number of school districts and encourage a number of boards to submit a needs budget simultaneously, we could go from simply handing the government an administrative annoyance of signing off, getting rid of the trustees in one district and putting in a ministry trustee, instead to force a political crisis upon this government. Because it seems to me that when you're faced with such a concerted effort of a siege with a plan and a method of execution, we have to have a strategic means in between elections to actually force their hand, to say, this is not, first of all, what you promised. Second of all, this is not what people demand or expect. And we have to figure out a way in which we can bring into play our potential, our power and energies, and figure out some kind of way to coordinate them. I think that one of the problems of one board standing up with a needs budget, generally the experience has been that the community will tend to be in the dark about why they did that, and they haven't done it in coordination with other boards. And essentially, it leads to a uncomfortability for a few moments for the government, but it doesn't seem to feed into some kind of broader political crisis to expose the bankruptcy of what they're trying to carry out. Now, we're really in the end, very much at the beginning of this process. I'm part of a minority on our board. I started out as one trustee. We had a by-election because one of the trustees on the board couldn't take it anymore. And we ran in the by-election with our own candidate. And in January, that candidate was elected. And so we've tried to think about the way in which our political action can feed directly in and support the community organizing that we're doing. So now with two trustees, we not only can strategize better at the board table, but we can expand our community-based activity that frankly drives the rest of the board crazy. Such things as school visits, to go to school to meet with parents and staff, to talk about the challenges they're facing in their schools, and to suggest ways in which people can come together to face these challenges. This is seen as rather unfair, because, this isn't how we do things. We sit here at the board table, we rubber stamp the recommendations of administrators. We're part of a team here, a management team. But we're not willing to play ball that way. We're not willing to feed into this end game. Our loyalties are with the community first and foremost. And it's through that process that we've actually come to learn that and challenge our roles as political representatives. That rather than seeing ourselves as part of the management team, as local dignitaries who float in to events be the person who puts their head through the pie-throwing contest and so forth. Instead, what our real role is, what we were elected to do, was to provide leadership in engaging with members of the community, in trying to draw out those connections, the commonalities and the experience people are facing, and suggest the kind of initiatives that can facilitate the kind of resistance we need to stand up to this siege. I think that it also has been very challenging for our union partners, our union comrades. They have been instrumental in terms of providing the space for the kinds of initiatives that we need in the community to fight what's going on. That I think for people in the unions where we're working, particularly in all three, IWA and QP and the teachers union, we've had to learn that we need an open and more direct and assertive role in politics. It's not simply enough to just say, well, we'll support those people and we'll just hope that it'll all work out. It also has challenged the unions to address both the community and workplace interests of working people and to try to draw out those commonalities. That yes, the interests of their members and at the bargaining table are important, but they are important as they exist within a broader set of concerns of working people. That the people in the home, in the community, in the workplace, we actually have needs that need to be met. And finally, we're not going to get anywhere unless we convince everyday people who are not activists that their activity is absolutely critical in building the kind of resistance we need. That if they expect and want something decent in their communities, in their societies, they cannot leave it to somebody else to give it to them. Because the simple truth is, that if we leave politics to somebody else, we are allowing it to be captured by interests who do not share our well-being, who are determined, who have, as I said, this end game in mind. And they will implement it whether we support it or not. So we have to make sure that the kind of activity we're promoting in our communities is actually being successful in drawing out the activity of the working people where we live. And that is, I would say, one area where we have had some success and came out in our election campaign, that in our what turned out to be a victory party, I looked around. And I've been part of different activist groups. I've been in student activism and so forth. And you get used to a certain kind of routine. You get used to a certain comfort level where everyone thinks the same and everyone has a similar cultural sense. And I looked around at the people who were at this event, and I could see teachers with support workers, teaching assistants, with janitors, with bus drivers, with maintenance workers, and these were the people whose activity was absolutely critical to the election of our second trustee. And in fact, in the case of one part of the district in the Lake Cowichan area, that is what put us over the top. And I'll tell you, it wasn't me going around telling people how to vote that made any difference. It was the janitors. It was the bus drivers. They were the people who went out into their communities and convinced people we want to defend our schools, we want to defend the services and the programs our kids deserve. It is important that you get out there. And in this one area in particular, we really saw the results, the benefits of everyday people realizing that they had power and they could act on that. And then finally, what I want to touch upon is, too, that I think it has also challenged, our experience has challenged the sense of how parents will come to be active in defending the public system that they want for their children. And it does require, I think, first and foremost, that parents reject their role as being one of consumer advisors to this ministry agenda, where they essentially say, well, we're not happy with the service we're getting, like a waiter who's come over and isn't shuffling fast enough. And unfortunately, that has been the character of the parent advisory groups in many areas, including our own area. It isn't the only voice that's there, but it has been a view, especially in a vacuum where people are not involved, when people are so demoralized, one big mouth shouting for blood and shouting for attacking the unions essentially seems to have such an effect in convincing people that, oh, well, that's what parents think. And it is being by having other parents step up and say, well, hang on a minute. We recognize that we have some common social interests here between schools. You know, I work in another job. There are people who work in the school district who are parents, who recognize those connections. And it's by recognizing and acting on those connections and shared commonalities that you actually build the kind of positive alternatives we need to break this siege on our public education system. And that has been, I think, probably the most challenging part of our work in terms of breaking through that crust of the official parent point of view coming from the ministry and trying to actually have a character that really is organic to the needs of our community. I think finally, it's challenging the community as a whole to rethink about how we see community and the role of community in the struggle and in the struggle for the kind of public education system we want. On the one hand, to recognize diversity as a strength, as not as a means of dividing, but as a means of understanding that by having the kind of different priorities, we can actually We can actually draw out the complementary strengths and energies that people have. And that through this diversity, we can see the shared interests of different communities and the need to build the kind of alliances that are actually able to go from simply being community, putting forward their own, what is seen as pet interest, to community standing together as a whole, who do not have to relinquish their own identities, their own priorities, but can draw out some kind of shared vision of what kind of public services that they're going to demand for their children. And this is particularly important in the Cowichan Valley because we have a large Hokomino communities. The native communities whose land it is, including the land we stand on here, the fact that there's been such a long space running where we have not sought to build a new relationship between the newcomer and native communities, I think is a key weakness for popular politics in this province. And we're finding that in our own locale. And actually having partners in the native communities who are willing to stand up and be confident about what they expect, about the path that they want to take their communities on, to work with us as equals for shared interests, which is about having decent public services, it's about having decent wages, it's about having a national democratic system that has some kind of real meaning in people's lives, and it is about respecting the fact that we have different peoples who can walk on different paths and yet still come together to defend their shared interests. And I just put that to you because all through this province we have that legacy that we have to address. And it's particularly incumbent upon those of us who are part of newcomer communities to initiate that kind of dialogue with the native communities who for too long have been denied what are their basic human rights, to follow the path of their choosing rather than an imposed one. Because I'll tell you, by having native communities being forced to enter into some kind of, to be forced down this path of colonization, to have other people impose their interests on them, that has paved the way by which all communities are being made victims in this new wave of free market colonialism that is taking away the gains that people have built up through decades of struggle in terms of decent wage employment, in terms of public services, in terms of the democratic guarantees that we have been able to establish, and essentially cashing them in for the bottom line of corporations and the people who stand with them. So I would very much urge people to think about the commonalities of the siege that we're facing, that it seems this end game that they're trying to play out. They want to bind all the fates of communities together to send them down a particular path. We have to now work that to our advantage. If they've bound the fates of all our communities together, and they've made it clear that they will no longer accept what people have accomplished through decades of struggle, then we have to make some kind of final stand to say, no, we are not going to turn our backs on the sacrifices that people have made to achieve what we take for granted today. We are going to not only fight to turn back this siege, but we are in fact going to resolve to expand what the guarantees that people should rely upon, the guarantees that people should expect, the kind of guarantees that people deserve. Because if we want to build a truly human society, that is what it's going to take. There is no halfway measure. There is no way in which that humane society can coexist with the US-dominated free market. We have to make a very hard decision here. We have to resolve ourselves to look, let's draw on our traditions. Let's look at the people who struggled with far less means than our own and achieved a tremendous amount that they themselves probably did not ever dream could actually be achieved. Let's look on those traditions as a way of facing our contemporary challenges, to say we don't have to accept this cynical end game. We can remake the society along lines in which the interests of working people in which the interests of Native peoples can come together and can be the priority in our political system, in the kind of economic guarantees that people have, and in a broader culture, in the broader culture of humanity. So thank you for the time today, and I very much would encourage anyone who is interested in the idea of building community support for needs budgets and the idea that we should be coordinating those efforts, please, we're over in that area there, sectioned off, please come over, talk with us, and we really want to work with you, with folks. Thank you very much.